So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, we review the coverage of another unpredictable election campaign with an unexpected win for a major broadcaster. There's a new chief executive at Channel 4. Maggie Brown is here to tell us all about her and what she needs to do to keep the corporation on an even keel. Plus, Hopkins leaves LBC. Apple blow the doors off podcasting. The Radio Academy returns with a rebooted awards due. And in the media quiz, we reveal the wolves in sheep. Clothing. It's all to come on today's media podcast. And joining me today at Picture House Central, our creative director of TV indie Lemonade Money, it's Faraz Osman, and Heat Magazine's entertainment director, Boyd Hilton. Boyd, you've been at a screening today.
Yes. Oh, I can't really talk about that. It's strictly embargoed.
Can you give us a star rating without saying what it was?
Yes, I'll give you the star rating of 2 stars.
Ooh!
Yeah.
I look forward to reading the review at a later date.
Yeah.
It wasn't Baby Driver, was it?
No, oh, no, Baby Driver is great. Baby Driver's 5.
Fine, yeah. Good. Okay. Good.
Process of elimination.
This is so secret, I can't say what it is.
Faraz, what is on your secret slate at the moment?
We are hustling as usual. We've got a few things that we're chatting about that I can't talk about, unfortunately, because they're in development.
Come on,
the exciting thing is that a fourth season of Four to the Floor is on air on Channel 4 right now. So that's doing great guns. We've got a new presenting cast on that. So they're on the couch reviewing and talking about the best in new music. So it's quite exciting. Yeah, Check that out.
I didn't get a call. And joining us down the line from her writing den in South London, it is media writer Maggie Brown. Hi, Maggie.
Hi there.
I imagine you were just finishing your second history on Channel 4 when Jay Hunt resigned. How's the book going?
Well, actually, the book is going fine. All I can say is that I'm actually quite relieved. It's all kind of clear-cut now. It's much better to have nice, clean decisions and the end of one era. And also, I'm actually quite pleased because all of my forecasts came true that you never have an internal candidate. So a little boost of confidence because, of course, the favoured insider was Jay Hunt and for a variety of reasons, she didn't get it.
Well, more of that later. That's what we call a tease. But let's start with the big news story, the election, because as has been widely discussed by other more venerable outlets, the result of this snap election was totally unexpected for pretty much everyone. Well, pretty much everyone full stop, but certainly in our industry, who pretty much all assumed a majority of some kind for the Conservatives. Let's start with the coverage, though, especially once that exit poll was announced, because the BBC, ITV, Sky and Channel 4 were all running with live coverage when suddenly it seemed like something you might want to actually watch. What did you make of what you saw, Boyd?
Oh, it was tremendously exciting and uplifting. And I voted very late, actually, in the end, because I did most of it in the morning. So I went to vote.
You swung it.
It was in my youth. Yeah, I'm in the youth vote, definitely. I mean, you're nearly 50 youth vote.
Was there a Labour bribe for TV journalists?
If there isn't, there should be. So I voted kind of fairly last minute. Then I went home and pretty much switched on BBC One. I always go to I think probably most people, I go to BBC One first, as is tradition. I
feel for matters of state importance.
Saw the exit poll and was tremendously excited. But of course, they're always talking about how, you know, it may well be wrong. And I assumed it would be wrong. I mean, I totally assumed it would be wrong, especially with all the warnings. Then once John Curtis starting having the kind of ongoing discussion slash slightly spiky row with is it Peter Kellner? They had like two polling experts. Curtis was up on that weird balcony. Peter Kellner was down sitting with David Dimbleby. He thought, oh, he must know what he's talking about, and he's been on the BBC One for about 30 years. And he completely trashed the exit polls after the first two results came in from the North East, like Sunderland and Newcastle, or whatever. And I thought, oh, it's going to be a bad night. And then the next few results came in, and then it was incredible. It was a roller coaster. But I have to say, I'm sure you kind of alluded to this in your introduction, but I did feel, as some kind of TV critic, that I should flick around and check the other broadcasters. And immediately I was drawn to ITV. I just thought having Ed Balls and George Osborne was a masterstroke. And having them throughout the night commenting, they developed a little relationship. Obviously, they know each other. And they were kind of funny and kind of outrageous. And Osborne was being incredibly critical of Theresa May. I mean, fair enough. And it was even more exciting on ITV, I have to say. So for the first time in my lifetime, really, I kind of thought, right, I'm going to stick mostly with ITV and check Channel 4 and Sky fairly regularly as well. But I was amazed by myself that I was picking ITV over BBC One.
And there was less visibly money on screen, I mean, apart from what they paid George Osborne and Ed Balls, wasn't there, on ITV? They were sitting in a little boxy room.
Yeah, it was
BBC,
a virtual,
this massive aircraft hangar, basically.
I mean, BBC, and I have to say the BBC went way over the top, because it's fine to have, I didn't mind all the graphics and the spectacular huge studio, but having Curtis up on that balcony was weird, talking down to them. It just looked odd. And then you had Michelle Hussein, I think it was, in a different interview area, interviewing other people, as well as David Dimbleby doing some interviews in his area. And then you had, it was just too many people and different types of graphs from one person. And another person. It was just a Jeremy Vining one type of, and it was like, do we really need that many? And then ITV, I think there was a kind of simplicity to it, to kind of a core team. And it was much infinitely preferable, I thought.
Yeah, I think my favourite tweet of the evening, actually, and I've forgotten, I'm afraid, who did it, but it was someone tweeting, and now over to Jeremy Vine for live analysis, and they'd put a picture of Homer Simpson doing Tron. And that's exactly
Absolutely.
What it was like.
Yeah.
What did you think, Faraz, of the various different competitors, and did you flick beyond ITV?
I'm also part of the eat my hat trick of failures when it comes to calling election coverage now, and it was exciting. You kind of almost felt like, you know, it was a bit of a stitch up. It's like, well, how do we get audience figures to election coverage? I know, let's put a cliffhanger right at the beginning and see if people stick with it. But I kind of agree with Boyd. It's I think the BBC, it's one of those things that the BBC know that every single politician is watching that coverage. So it's a time for them to kind of go, we need to make sure we get it right, because there's probably going to be a conversation about the licence fee further down the line. So we need to make sure we represent everybody fairly, get everybody on there and make sure that they understand that this is a public service broadcaster that's paid for by your licence fee, etc. But it did feel a little bit rough around the edges, as not as slick, you know. And also it did genuinely feel across all of the channels when I was flicking around that they were caught with their pants down a little bit when it came to the exit polls, and they were all kind of thinking on their feet, which made it really exciting. I watched a little bit of the Channel 4 coverage, which I thought was better than it has been in previous years. I think having Alistair Campbell on it was really shrewd, and that really helped. And so I did really enjoy that.
It was kind of the same idea as last time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
With pretty much the same main team, I think David Mitchell
and
Paxman.
And Richard Osman is new. And I think Osman really fits that
good,
role.
Yeah.
And I think that he's the right sort of person to have there. Yeah. And I think playing off his pointless role of being almost like a stato in the corner really works in this space, because he can also be funny at the same time.
Well, what about what that says about Channel 4 News, though, Maggie? I mean, you know, this is their big night, isn't it? And it's, okay, it's not like the BBC, where they've got Koonsberg and Marr and Robinson, and they're all battling it out to talk the most about what's going on. But they've got a lot of talent at Channel 4 News, and instead of them being on screen for the election results, you're watching talent poached from the BBC to effectively do a comedy show.
Yes, I know. I mean, I think it will probably all be reviewed. As a news programme, Channel 4 News has actually had a good election, in my opinion. So I sampled it, but I didn't stay with it, because I just thought, I've seen enough, I know what it's like, that the real news story, whichever channel you watch, and I watch Sky News as well, was just unfolding somewhere else. The thing I'm missing at the moment, though, am I the only one who fell in love with Election Spy? Did anybody watch that on BBC?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was
good. Before you went into Newsnight after the 10 o'clock news. It was so funny. Just that brilliant 5 minutes. And I would have loved a sort of an after-the-election dissection by that team. It was hat-trick, actually, with their best script.
Should we talk about the papers? Because, John Prescott tweeted that Rupert Murdoch had stormed out of the news building after the exit poll. How weak are the tabloids now are predicting this kind of thing or influencing it?
Totally pointless. I think someone did deny that John Prescott story, didn't they? I think someone from the Times said it wasn't true. But we want it to be true, obviously, because that would be hilarious. I mean, I think always the influence of the tabloid press has been overemphasised. You know, the Sun claimed themselves that they won it, you know, 1 year, and you know, they're so predictable. It's like the least surprising thing on earth was that the Mail and the Sun particularly were going to go hell for leather, pro-Conservative, pro-Theresa May, and hysterically anti-Corbyn, and they absolutely lived up to that level of hysteria that we expected. But it was so blatant, I think, and it's become so blatant and kind of boringly obvious that I think people are completely, just don't give a damn anymore. You know, obviously left-wing people like me, I'm pinging my colours to the mast. Obviously, never in a million years would I think of taking seriously what the Sun or the Mail say. But I think more than that, they're turning off their own core, you know, if you like, kind of similar to the Tories, actually. I think people are just finding it...
I think you're absolutely right. They should really have an examination of themselves because it's almost like signing a death warrant if you are disconnected from such a large percentage of the younger population. I just think that they have to actually refresh their approach, but I don't think they will, unfortunately. No. They are, you know, rinsed in their own political viewpoints, and it's all part and parcel of both the vision that they project of the world and the people that they sort of employ to do it. I don't know how long they can go on sustaining this sort of pantomime act, to be honest. I thought that the Times did a very good job, actually, in trying to be balanced and trying to report. The Financial Times obviously does what it does, and The Guardian had a range of opinion as well, although it obviously leant towards Corbyn. But for the tabloids themselves, I don't know how they can't just assume that the younger population now we'll just be happy with the Mail Online sort of showbiz content as well.
Well, we're all talking as if Labour absolutely smashed it just because they did better than we expected. The Tories did win, but what does that mean for their manifesto promises on the media? Because, of course, they haven't won one with a capital W, have they? Is Channel 4 going to move north? Will Section 40 be scrapped? Will Leveson 2 be scrapped? Who'd like to jump in on one of those? Maggie?
Well, I think that the election commitment over Channel 4. There's a consultation taking place about possible relocations, also whether it can invest much more as a shareholder into developing independent producers and then selling them on a whole range of issues over Channel 4. Two thoughts, really. It seems quite clear to people that Nick Timothy, who of course is now out in the the cold darkness of wherever he is...
Careful what you say, Maggie, because he might end up being your editor.
Was Erdington man, and he was credited with being the person who in particular thought that it was time for Channel 4 to move out and maybe to go to his favoured second city, after all, Birmingham. So you might say that there's a weakening of that resolve. At the same time, of course, we have got Karen Bradley back as Culture Secretary, who was very much in favour of this move and had said at a conference in Salford at the end of March that the government and Channel 4 were very far apart on this issue. So it may be something that will continue because it isn't apparently that contentious in political terms, because there might well be a view in the Labour camp that some sort of better reporting or better coverage and representation of areas outside of London would be very welcome indeed. Remember, Ofcom has to have a new chair. Patricia Hodgson is leaving at the end of the year. Ofcom, incredibly powerful media and communications regulator, so that's another thing that's up for grabs too. So, you know, interesting times.
And Maggie, since our last show, Channel 4 have announced their new chief exec as well.
Yes.
That's Alex Mann. Maggie, what do we know about her?
Well, Alex Mann is the first woman to be a chief executive of Channel 4. She'll be the seventh. She has come very much from outside of the broadcaster's area. Her career, 17 years, has been, apart from being a management consultant, has been at Fremantle, part of the RTL group, which makes all sorts of programmes like The X Factor. And then she, of course, went over to help Elizabeth Murdoch at Shine execute a whole number of deals, which then led to a merger within Endemol. And she basically now, after running the Foundry, which does special effects for filmmakers, has landed this top job. But she also, if you read the spec that the company was advertising, you will see that it had a number of pointers to her, which said, for example, they wanted somebody who knew a deep understanding of international markets. Well, that's most certainly her, because that's what the Shine Endemol company was about, and so indeed was Fremantle. An experience of business building, inspiring teams through change, and a balanced mix of creative and commercial organisation. About the one thing she doesn't know very much about is the advertising market. And this is no small area for Channel 4, since it's 95% dependent on advertising.
And they've got to pay for Bake Off.
And they've got to pay for Bake Off. And there has been, I think, probably quite accurate reporting that some of the hopes for Bake Off, the sponsorship area, they hope there'll be a great competition for it, has not been quite as rosy as they expected. So,
yeah. Mr. Kipling can name their price at the moment.
Well, that's about the one thing she doesn't tick a box for. And of course, the problem is that it's not, one can fully understand this, but the person who thought she was going to get it from inside, Jay Hunt, the creative director, announced she was leaving on the Friday before Alex Mann's appointment was confirmed. So she's leaving and saying she's going almost before the new chief executive arrives. Now, it's inevitable new chief executives would have probably found their own new team, but it's quite a sort of a rapid exit in terms of the way television normally works.
I mean, presumably, I mean, the gossip is that's because she wanted that job, right? And she was David Abrams' favourite for that job.
There were four people in the final round, and she was one of them. In fact, there were three women and one man. And, I mean, she was the person that was the internal candidate left in the race. Channel 4 is quite a small organisation, 830 people. It handles a lot of contracts. Sometimes it's actually a form of perhaps rather brutal self-renewal, that you do go every 6 or 7 years or so to the outside market and get a new person in.
Faraz, one of the things that the new chief executive will have to do is replace Jay Hunt pretty soon, as Maggie was saying. What would you be looking for in a new chief creative officer?
Well, I actually spoke to a few friends of mine who said that there's a possibility that the role might be split, which could be quite interesting. So there could be a creative role, and there could be a more of an administrative role, which may balance out the fact that there's been some conversations about Alex's experience in programme making. So,
but, I mean, you used to work for Channel 4, didn't you? If you were looking for someone to run it now, what do you think they need?
Well, I think that there's already some really interesting names in the frame. Based on my failure of predicting any politics in the last few years, I'm not going to put my head above the parapet and suggest that I think there's going to be one name that's above the others. But I actually welcome the change. If it's really interesting to kind of see the fact that when Jay first came in, Netflix hadn't launched in the UK. You know, Amazon Prime Video wasn't even a thing that would been coined, let alone, you know, was existing. And the market is now completely different to what it was when Jay first joined and David Abrams first joined, and we've got something that's completely new and a whole new set of challenges, and I think that by the time we have a new team in there, when we get to the end of it, it will be a completely different and possibly unrecognisable company from what it is today. And that goes down to what actually Channel 4's for, and is it just about being a programme maker, is it a publisher, is it going to own more and more indies? And so I don't think I'm hoping that it's not just going to be a straight, well, let's pick another person that's leading another channel or leading another place, plonk them in there and they can be a creative from there. It would be nice to see if the field was opened up a little bit, to see if, you know, are there some online creatives that we haven't spoken about before? Are there some, you know, even radio creatives or digital creatives that don't necessarily fit into the normal TV mould that might be able to shake things up and look at it from a different perspective? It's born risky, after all.
And Boyd, you professionally have to sit through all the big new shows on Channel 4 when they're launched. What is Jay Hunt's legacy? Because there have been some highlights, but, you know, are they representative? You know, The Island, Humans, First Dates, people talk about those, but
Catastrophe. I think she's done a good job, you know. I think I remember probably 3 or 4 years ago, maybe, I hosted the Edinburgh controller session with Jay, and at the time, you know, she faced a lot of criticism in the industry, and I think, and it was packed, it was so full, it was in the biggest auditorium at the festival, and they were locking people out because there was there was such a kind of frenzied, do you remember, there was like a frenzied feeling that, you know, she had to go from some people, mainly because I think people thought the channel was getting tired in terms of its creativity, but I think she totally pulled it back. And I think in the last 3 or 4 years I think right now it's in rude health. I think it's got some really strong comedy, drama. I think in fact entertainment it's kind of ruling the roost with, as you say, First Dates and shows like that, The Last Legs doing really well. I think Channel 4 is the hardest of the major channels to be creatively in charge of, I have to say. I mean, I think BBC, you know, I could run BBC One. That's arrogant. But you know what I mean? You know, it's like you've got hundreds of millions of pounds, you know, massive budget. You've got the world's creative people at your disposal. Channel 4, it's like a harder, that real tough balance, I think.
You're criticised for doing comfortable.
Right, you are. Yeah, and as soon as
you do something, one, you're allowed to
if you do something supposedly safe, you know, mainstream, you get criticism. If you do too well, you know, in ratings almost, the Bake Off decision was, of course, highly controversial. But anyway, I think generally she will have been shown historically to have done a good job, and I think Channel 4 right now is in a really good state, and I enjoy watching it. I mean, I hardly even watch Channel 5, for example. So generally, I think it's doing well. Yeah.
How interesting, though, that her challenge when she came in was to get rid of the albatross that was Big Brother, and that left. And now whoever her success is going to be, their challenge is going to be making Bake Off work. So it's almost like, well, you've lost one albatross, and she's let another one in through the window.
Funnily enough, of course, two things about that. One, right now, Love Island on ITV2 is totally slaughtering Big Brother. Normal Big Brother, non-celebrity Big Brother is over, I think, and Love Island has totally taken its place. It's a phenomenon among our readers and the young. You know, they much prefer it as a format. The other thing is that I think generally the Bake Off, I was furious when the whole Bake Off thing happened, but I have to say, I hear from journalists who've been on set and have interviewed the new team, they're loving it. And I think it's going to be much better, much less of a disaster than people like me thought.
I don't know. I think
until
8 million people see prediction. Noel Fielding for the first time.
No,
is what
well,
I say
you
to
wait.
That.
I think people will like it.
Okay. So. Maggie, yeah. Final thought for you. Let's cut straight in. Who are the contenders we should be looking out for to replace Jay Hunt, in your view?
Well, I think that there's certainly one of her previous employees, Shine's creative director, who works at Channel 4, is actually overseeing the Great Bake Off. I don't know, because the thing is that it isn't as simple as people are making out, because I think that there was going to be probably no one single creative director, that the decision-making may be returned a bit more to people. So it's more of a consensual approach and a change from this. Jay Hunt was running a very pyramidical structure with her very much at the top with everything referred upwards. So although of course there will be a figure, I think it will be something that is less stamped with that individual's personality.
We'll have to buy the third volume of the biography to find out who it is.
I think that would be a good move, by the way. I think giving more power to the individual, you know, commissioners in the different departments. I think I've always wondered, the controllers, it's quite a kind of, feels to me quite a old school way of running a channel, you know. The team that
well,
Jay
Hunt... That was the way that they were able to get Jay Hunt in, because she was a very big fish. She was the controller of BBC One.
Sure.
And so she could almost dictate her terms. I'm not sure the next person will be able to do that. The other thing you have to remember, I don't actually agree with your analysis, Boydie, in one sense, that Channel 4 is fighting for market share and impact, and that's precisely why it went for the Great British Bake Off. It wanted to have a big catch that it could sell to advertisers and to draw in people who don't normally watch Channel 4. It's partly why there's so many fixed rig programs still there, like One Born Every Minute and 24 Hours in A&E, which has actually a big reach. A lot of the shows that people love, Catastrophes, are quite small shows, really. And so they do have to keep an eye. This is what I come back to. They do have to keep an eye pie on the commercial side of the business. 95% of its income at the moment comes from advertising. One of Alex's challenges is going to be how you change that.
Maggie Brown, thank you. We'll have more after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Time for some news in brief now. Faraz and Boyd are still with me. Apple had their annual developers conference last week and announced a new product to rival Amazon's Echo device. But more interesting to podcast nerds like us is the announcement that they are going to open up their podcast listening analytics to publishers. Boyd, what does that mean?
Well, from what I understand, I've got two podcasts, by the way, Footballistically Arsenal and The Heat I'm a Supporter. Go and subscribe now on iTunes. But as far as I understand, it's a way of finding out what listeners like within your podcast. Is that right? You know, they'll tell you if they suddenly stop listening after 20 minutes. Beyond that, I genuinely don't understand how they're going to tell us what the listeners like or don't like about a podcast. Because I might stop listening to a podcast if I find it boring after 25 minutes, but then I'm not going to carry on afterwards. So it's a bit of an odd one. Maybe you know more than me.
Well, I presume that the information will be, for example, instead of just people who like this also like, Apple have data on every podcast that someone's downloaded, so they can tell you 80% of people that listen to Mayo and Kermode have also tried out Boyd Hilton, for example.
Okay.
And then there's the issue about when they drop off, yeah. And I wonder for us, actually, whether that's fair data in a way, because I've seen a lot of podcasters get excited about the idea that they'll finally be able to say to advertisers, look, it's not just about our subscriber numbers, as Boyd just boasted of, you know, subscribe to my show, and then you get the download numbers. It might be that I can prove to you advertisers that our people, our listeners, they're still listening after 35 minutes. They love our show that much, they're still listening. But of course, it could prove the opposite, couldn't it? It could prove that most listeners never press play on the show they've downloaded.
The magic in digital marketing is that you pick the analytic that works best for your message, as it were. So some people talk about, and it's been happening on the web for ages, some people talk about the amount of hits they get, some people talk about dwell time, some people talk about how many links are being linked to that site, etc. And you find a big bashy figure that reels in the advertiser. And I think the more that you can get, the more that you can tailor your presentation to advertisers accordingly. So I think that the more data that we can make available to everyone, the better, because it means that hopefully we can attract more of an audience into this space. And it is still quite new. And I know we feel like we've been talking about it for decades, and we probably have. But when it comes to actually maturing, I think that there have been things that that have meant that more and more people are subscribing to it. And, you know, there's the obvious touch points of Serial. But I think that we've also found that more political analysis is happening on podcasts. People are getting into talk radio a lot more. And all of those things are kind of cumulatively, hopefully, bringing in more advertisers. And because, let's be honest, I'm sure people who have subscribed to this have subscribed to lots of other podcasts. And it generally is the same advertisers again and again and again. Yes. And that's kind of part of the story.
And that's weird, I think. You know, because if you listen to some American shows now, the big ones, you have finally got companies like Ford sponsoring Startup, for example. General Motors have a drama podcast. But in the UK, you know, it's not Vauxhall supporting shows, is it? It is still bloody MailChimp and Squarespace and, you know, Amazon Video and Blue Apron and these companies that basically are issuing a code. Mm. I mean, God bless you, Squarespace. I love you. Use your code, MediaPod, to get
on any of those websites and you'll get a discount.
And that's because they can show that listeners come through, use their code and then monetize it. But why aren't Ford advertising on podcasts in the UK? Why is that still not happening?
Yeah, it's weird. I think there are just too many people out there who just still don't really know what a podcast is, genuinely, in that kind of level of, you know, people who, that level of power, if you like. I went to a big event at Sky recently, and I was talking to lots of people much more high powered than me, and I was telling them about my podcast, and they were like, oh, I haven't listened to a podcast ever, you know. I'm like, really? And so I think it is, as you say, a new thing. One thing I hope the analytics thing solves is, when I first started doing my Arsenal podcast years ago, I was told very firmly that it had to be 35 minutes and not a minute longer. I think I mentioned this before on this podcast, and I was like, why? And I was like, oh, no one listens to longer than 35 minutes. But all the best podcasts, yeah, you know, are epic. They're massively long. Brace and Ellis, new one, goes on for about 2 hours.
Yeah, but mobile data didn't exist when you started doing podcasts,
right,
did it?
But no, that was the thing about apparently
people... So you used to have to download it, plug in your iPod,
but I don't think that was even the reason. The reason that we were told was that people tune out. But I think all my favourites go on for hours and hours. That's the great thing about them. So if the analytics can solve that mystery, I'll be pleased.
Well, if I may ironically move us on now, let's talk about radio, because whilst we were away... LBC released Katie Hopkins from her contract. That's pretty much all you can say about it, because she's agreed to not issue a comment about it, and they've said nothing other than Katie Hopkins has left. But she did send quite a few offensive tweets before the one that seemed to break the camel's back. Faraz, what do you think took them so long?
The thing is that people like Katie Hopkins bring in audiences, whether we like them or not. I mean, you know, it's difficult to talk about anything without mentioning Donald Trump's name at the moment, but it's the same sort of argument. You know, nobody really listens to people that say the same as everybody else. And Katie Hopkins was very successful, rightly or wrongly, for being an Asian provocateur and actually, you know, sticking her head above the parapet and saying things that nobody else would say. I think that she obviously got consumed by her own power, thankfully, and got there in the end. But the reality is that she is famous because people listen to her and get outraged by her. If you didn't get outraged by her, then she would never have an audience and she would never have got an LBC show in the first place.
Exactly, but the timeline wasn't she got recruited by LBC for being provocative and then went over the line. She said that migrants should drown in the sea, and then she got a show on LBC.
Yeah.
So what did they think they were getting?
I think they were arrogant. I think, like a lot of people in charge of these kind of things, they were arrogant enough to think, oh, it doesn't matter. As you say, she's a professional controversialist. If we're going to... And there's quite a few of those on the station. Yeah, Ian Dale is quite, you know, kind of spiky, provocative, right-wing commentator. I think he's very good, by the way.
He's nothing like her.
He has his moments.
Fuzzy,
no, he has his moments where he gets...
Consensual,
Ferrari's
more like
Ferrari, yeah. But they have very opinionated,
yes,
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
James O'Brien on the left, yeah, you know, they all have rants.
This is like the meeting where they got rid of me from my contract.
Sorry, all I'm saying is all those people stock in trade, and the thing they all put on social media is when any of them have a big rant about something, and they're all capable of it, that's their big stock in trade, and I think they're all good at it. The problem with her was she went too far, I think, for our taste, and I think for LBC it has got a good reputation. It's been going for decades and decades. I think they made a big mistake in the first place giving her the job, because the rest of the people at the station, I think, were annoyed. People, you know, there's really good people there. Sheila Fogarty is a great broadcaster, you know, X5 Live. I haven't spoken to her about it. I imagine she didn't have much respect for Katie Hopkins, and I think when your own and apparently the employees cheered when it was announced that she was leaving, and that's the thing. You can't, the bosses thought maybe she'd do well in the ratings and give us some hits on social media, but it's not worth it because everyone hated her.
I'm sure you've got some international listeners to this podcast, and it feels like an idiosynchronicity, because when you look at America and you look at talk radio in America, it's vile. It's absolutely, yeah, vile. And you have people like Rush Limbaugh, and you have people like Alex Jones, who are saying the most atrocious things, like about Sandy Hook and the fact that it was all a hoax and they all put it on. And these people are getting press access now to the White House, for better or worse. And so, you know, LBC, it's not difficult to see why they're tempted by that model, because it does have influence and it does have power. And when it comes to television, you know, newspapers, yes, obviously she's got a column in newspapers, but as that's become less and less powerful, the print media, radio, there is an opportunity for radio to kind of pick up that baton, as it were, and they obviously have to be more careful because they have stronger guidelines around them. But it doesn't surprise me that LBC have been trying this model, which has worked for them. They've become an incredibly successful radio station recently because of doing this. So, you know, it's about sailing as close to the wind as possible without going, right, that's too close, and now we're going to move on from there. And one of the things that I'm aware of is, if you look at what's happening in Fox News in America, it's advertisers that are pulling the rank there. So when advertisers, you know, things, some of those presenters have done the most atrocious things, has been completely ignored. And it's only recently that you've seen people like Bill O'Reilly being fired, not because of what they've done, but because of what advertisers have said, no, that's enough. And I think that that's starting to happen around a rhetoric of like, you know, stop, you know, we're going to stop reading the Daily Mail and yeah, stop funding hate, the Stop Funding Hate campaign.
Advertisers ended the News of the World, didn't they? When advertisers stopped pulling out, that's what ended it for the News of the World, I think.
And just to take that international ball by the horns for a second, this isn't necessarily a bad story for Katie Hopkins, is it? She's been on Fox and Friends talking about this.
Oh my God,
it seems to me that's her destiny, isn't it? She's going to be the British one on Fox.
Yeah, Fox is losing viewers as well. So this is not something that, like, I mean, I would say this, I hope that this is true, that the tide is turning now, where people have gone, you know what, this is enough. It's now gone all the way to the White House. This stupidity and nonsense has gone all the way to the White House. We can't continue to have conspiracy theories. It used to be a little bit of fun and we kind of shared it, kind of going, oh my God, it's outrage. Now it's actually proving to have political discourse and it's changing.
Alex Jones is the subject of a big mainstream interview coming up on NBC, isn't he, next week?
It's happened. Yes. It's outrageous. And he talks about the Sandy Hook conspiracy.
I think what I'd say about Katie Hopkins' future is I think she should create her own YouTube channel and stick with that. And I mean, YouTube, you know, if she goes too far, we'll have to get rid of her as well. But I interviewed Piers Morgan last week and he told me that him and her are the two most popular, widely read columnists in the country. And if that's true, she can carry on. Both of them can carry on in the Daily Mail. Mail readers will be happy. No one else needs to bother.
And finally, just before the quiz, the Radio Academy have announced the return of the ARIAs, the Audio and Radio Industry Awards. Talking about global again, aren't we, Boyd? Because yes. Last year they weren't part of the awards. They didn't show up. They didn't enter. They didn't sponsor it. Do you think that's going to be different this year?
Oh, I hope so. I hope so, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously I work for Bauer, so Bauer's their big rival. And I hope Bauer supports it. I'm sure they will. I just think there should be a radio awards. You know, the Sonys were a massive tradition. I think it felt like it mattered. And I'd like to see a kind of one big radio awards back. Yeah, definitely.
Have you seen any of the details of the award categories? Because they're quite interesting.
Oh, no, I haven't. No, go on.
They've changed the definition. So it's not just best sports show. It's best sports show / podcast.
That's good. Well, that's good, yeah. I mean, podcast should be in there. Obviously, the podcast awards were a huge
unfortunately,
success.
Well, there isn't a best media podcast category, obviously, otherwise. No. I'd like to think we'd at least
best
be nominated.
Best curly-haired media podcast presenter.
And actually, something I think that they have learned from the British Podcast Awards, genuinely, is the price. It's £25 to enter.
Oh, good.
And it's free to turn up if you're a Radio Academy member.
That's brilliant.
That has to be a good thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good thing. I think that like the more we can get people entering awards and having their craft celebrated, it just benefits everybody. It's good for discovery. It's good for ego. It's good for the craft because people up their game a little bit. And I can't see any disadvantage of it if more and more people can get access to it.
I did notice a couple of new categories for presenting as well, which does make me think maybe they were a bit disappointed by the talent who came up last year.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Just get some more presenters up, get more nominated. Right, there is just time for our media quiz. This week, it's entitled Transformers Publishers in Disguise. I'm going to assume the character of a media publisher of note that has disguised itself as another format. Your task is to deduce who I am and who, this week, I've decided to impersonate. You're not clear on the rules, just press rewind.
I didn't understand a word of that, but carry on.
It's the best of three. Buzz in with your name. So, Boyd, you will say
Boyd.
And Faraz, you will say
Faraz.
The winner is a hung parliament, the loser is a hard Brexit. And here is question number one. Who am I? Exclusive. Owen Jones ate my hamster. Who am I? And what story do I represent? Buzz in with your name when you know the answer.
Owen Jones ate my hamster.
It's a tabloid headline.
The Daily Star.
You've got to buzz in with your name.
Faraz, the Daily Star.
No. Who does Owen Jones write for?
The Guardian.
Yes.
Right.
So what's the story? Guardian going tabloid.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
No, right,
using
okay.
The
buzz in with your name.
Faraz.
Boyd.
Christ. Faraz, yes. What's the story?
So the Guardian are losing their Berliner and becoming a tabloid.
Correct.
They're changing the size of the paper.
They've been in Berliner format for over a decade. Why the change?
Is this, I don't know, Brexit? Like, they can't getting out of Berlin? And like,
it's going to be printed by Mirror Group, isn't it? And it's going to save
them
loads of money.
So, yes, they are saving loads of money.
Yeah.
Bit of a shame, I think. I mean,
yeah,
I don't.
No, it's fine. No one wants that clunky big thing.
No, it's distinctive and cool.
No,
I think.
No. It hasn't been cool for years. It's obviously,
as far as I'm concerned, one less reason to buy a paper copy of the Guardian, which I think is a shame. Here is question number two. Coming soon to an internet-connected screen near you. I'm a hybrid, but what am I? What's the story?
Faraz.
Faraz.
I'm going to say, is it about Netflix and the talk about them opening cinemas in America?
You're close.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you the point. The story is that Netflix and Amazon's production budgets are to eclipse UK box office takings. by 2020. Which
is incredible, yeah. Sorry, I did know that story, and it's unbelievable. I mean, I do believe it, but yeah, I didn't guess it from your overly contrived clue.
But it doesn't mean people aren't going to the cinema anymore. The cinema's still doing fine. People are going for big events, but they just prefer to watch.
Yeah, I mean,
stuff
there was a big controversy in Cannes when Netflix, you know, Netflix films were shown in competition, and people were outraged and said, you know, these films coming up on Netflix are going to be available on Netflix, and you don't have to go to cinema to see them. People are outraged. I think it's fine. We'll all come to terms with it.
I think it's a nonsense as well. I think what Netflix are doing is admirable. When they buy films, more people see them. It's as simple as
that. They make films. Yeah, I mean, I've just watched actually a new one called Okja, which is about a giant pig, and it's written by John Ronson. It's brilliant.
Okja.
Okja. Look out for it.
Okay, will do. Here is, it's the final question, but Faraz has already won. Try hard.
That's fine.
But, you know, Faraz has got this in the bag. Mr. Speaker, may I highlight to my right honourable friend that it's time for traffic and travel. Here's Sally Traffic.
Yeah, I know. Boyd.
This
is two politicians. I've forgotten who they are. Ian Duncan Smith is one of them.
Yeah.
And someone, Miliband.
That's right, yes.
Are going to get to...
True to brand in both cases.
Yes, they're going to get to host shows on Radio 2, is
yes,
that right?
Yes, in a move that's Jeremy. Not at all stolen from LBC.
Right.
The Jeremy Vine Show is going to be guest hosted by Ian Duncan Smith Ed Miliband.
Let me say right now, my mum is going to be furious because she loves Jeremy Vine. It religiously listens to him. And, I mean, Ian Duncan Smith, I'm sorry. I mean, I don't mind Miliband. Ian Duncan Smith is an unutterably tedious figure. I say it with full bias.
But also not a presenter.
No.
I mean, it's one thing, isn't it, to host a political phone-in, which I guess the Jeremy Vine Show kind of is, but it's also an entertainment show, isn't it, Faraz? It's going to be beyond their ability to do at the level you might want.
I didn't know this. This is news to me. I don't know. Is it going to bring back Millie fandom? Is that what they're trying to cash in on? It's an interesting one when politicians start branching out into media, and I think that obviously there's been lots of controversy about George Osborne being the new editor of the Evening Standard, and you know, is their media presence now part and parcel of what makes you a politician? Do you need to be a celebrity to represent the people? But I think, you know, fair enough, they're good names, they know what they're talking about, they've got some good experience behind them, and I think it'd just be interesting if it's going to be a bit of navel gazing, or if actually they're going to be able to give insight that nobody else can.
Well, as Nigel Farage actually says on LBC every night, I've done an hour's work. It's time to leave the building. So thank you very much to Boyd and Faraz. Faraz, you are the winner of the quiz.
Hooray.
Congrats. That is our show for today. My thanks to Faraz and Boyd and Maggie Brown as well. Who could forget that? Catch up with previous episodes and get new ones from us as soon as they're released by subscribing for free on our website, themediapodcast.com. This episode is dedicated to Andy Winter, who works for a students' union and has said he'd love it if we could big up student media groups URN Radio, Impact Magazine, and NSTV.
Go on, NSTV.
Consider them bigged up. Join Andy, keep us on the air, go to themediapodcast.com/donate and give generously. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.